Aloha, welcome to The Conversation. It's Friday, July 19th. I'm Russell Subiono.
And I'm Lillian Zhang. We're in for Catherine Cruz.
Today, we're bringing you a Hanaho show highlighting stories we've done recently about bugs.
Yes, those pesky invasive critters that give good guys like bees and ladybugs a bad rap.
So how did insects first get to our isolated state? One Harvard researcher has a theory on how the cockroach got to our islands. So gross. We'll also hear about efforts to fight the little fire ant on the Big Island and Oahu.
Plus, we'll hear what Hawaii farmers and home gardeners can do to fight lace bugs attacking avocado plants.
So keep your eyes open and get your big slipper ready just in case.
Or
your bottle of organic insecticide spray.
You're listening to The Conversation. I'm Russell Subiono.
And I'm Lillian Zhang. We're in for Catherine Cruz.
We have a Hanaho show about bugs for you today.
We're resharing recent interviews we've done about invasive insects in our islands.
And we're starting with public enemy number one, the cockroach. They're everywhere. But it didn't used to be that way. Take the tiny tan-colored German cockroach, one of the most common species you can find in Hawaii. It can't fly, nor does it live long enough to spend weeks at sea. So just how did the cockroach get here? Well, a new study looks at that.
So get this. Scientists had the fun job of studying the DNA of close to 300 German cockroaches from 51 sites, including Hawaii. They found evidence that the critters had an Asian ancestor over 2,000 years ago, but that Hawaii's cockroaches probably came from the continental U.S. Researcher Chen Tong led the way. He spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender earlier this year about his team's study.
I started my PhD in 2011. I'm particularly interested with the German cockroach because it is so common, but it seems like there's not many studies about it at that time. And also, like, it's so widespread, but people don't know where they're from. So after that, we start to look at literatures, try to trace the origin of this species. So the German cockroach was first described in Europe 250 years ago. And then we collected the regional first records. It seems like it's expanding from Europe to the rest of the world. And the first regional records actually peaked in early 20th centuries, which is, there's a lot of things going on in the early 20th centuries, the intensive globalization because of wars and commercial activities. That is the hypothesis of my PhD thesis, which the German cockroach introduced to Europe 250 years ago and then spread to the rest of the world with the European-like activities. And then we try to collect samples to perform a population genetic analysis to try to see if that's true, because we're also aware that the historical record may be biased.
And one of the places that you took cockroaches from was Hawaii. And I was wondering if you could just describe your sampling approach.
So actually, there are quite a few scientists studying cockroaches. So we contacted them, and then they have their own like connections to the local pest control operators. So these pest control operators, when they doing their jobs of pest management, they help us to collect some individuals. So the samples in Hawaii is actually collected by my collaborator, Prof. Ed Vargo in Texas A&M University.
Could you describe in basic terms, like, how you can get DNA out of a cockroach?
Yes, that's a good question. So for cockroach, it's a bit different from the others. You know, like, we try to avoid the abdomen because in the intestine, there's always like microbes. But also in cockroach, if you crush a cockroach, you see white stuff. That's the fat body. So in the fat body cells, they are also like living organisms, like protists or bacteria living in those cells and then live with the cockroach. So we try to avoid the abdomen. So my sampling is with the legs. So the legs is basically muscles. We take 2 to 3 legs and then crush them and then use a regular, like the commercial DNA extraction kit to get the DNA from the samples.
It's kind of good timing that we're talking about this because I have friends visiting Hawaii from out of state and they told me, oh my gosh, there are so many cockroaches everywhere, but this is an island in the middle of the Pacific. So how did they even get here?
Our analysis shows that the Hawaiian cockroach have no difference. There is no difference between the German cockroach in Hawaii and the ones in mainland United States. So to explain that, it seems like commercial or like passengers have brought the German cockroach from the mainland United States to Hawaii instead of, for example, like the next nearby continent is Australia, but it seems like not from Australia, but from the United States. So we also found that regardless of geographic proximity, the German cockroach populations are more closely related if they have more frequent commercial connections.
So countries or continents that have closer trade routes or a closer economic connection seem to have similar cockroaches when you look at their genetic makeup, because potentially you have shipping containers, you have trade going back and forth between these places, and it's easy for cockroaches to hitch a ride.
Yes.
Out of curiosity, why did you choose Hawaii as one of the sites? Is it because of that question of, oh, do the cockroaches get here from the mainland, or could they have come from Australia or even Asia?
Yes. Actually, I'm very glad to have the Hawaiian population for the reason that you just mentioned. Yeah. And also, this subject to the availabilities and the numbers of collaborators and their willingness to cooperate. So, for example, the entire South America, we just get like one sample point in Brazil. So, of course, we would welcome more samples.
Are there any other questions that you want to answer in future research? Like, what are still the questions you have about the German cockroach?
Actually, the more you study these species, the more questions you will have. For example, like you know the origin and you know the time frame. So 2,000 years ago, these German cockroach may be just like regular, like wild species, insect species feeding on leaf litters. And what makes it evolve so rapidly? And then to develop all these traits that adapt to a so different environment that was dominated by human. So this is a potentially very interesting topic with a lot of research questions. In the future, we would like to explore that a bit more. So for example, this insecticide resistance, is that the German cockroach have a so strong ability to develop new mutations, new genes, to cope with this insecticide in such short time, in like 100 or 200 years, or it is something already in their genes, but with the pressure from human, it become like more obvious.
As you learn more, there are even more questions. And I love that reframing of it, because we think of cockroaches as pests. We think, why are they everywhere? But from the cockroaches' perspective, they're incredibly successful evolutionarily.
Maybe I'm just speculating. Maybe next time if need to to explore the universe, like travel to another suitable planet, maybe can send cockroaches. I don't know.
How do you think about cockroaches? Like, if you see one in your house, what do you do?
I won't do much, actually. I would just keep the kitchen or rooms cleaner. Maybe there's less. And then I probably will not use the insecticide, as I know that they are not effective. So as long as they are not too abundant, then I won't be so worried about it because I'm not allergic to it. A lot of people are allergic to the cockroach. So having cockroach in the home may make them like uncomfortable or sick. So that's a concern for many people, but not for me.
Yeah, for you, it's just like, oh, we're taking research home with us.
That was Chen Tong, a postdoctoral researcher at Harvard University, who says he won't kill a cockroach he finds in his house. Well, that makes one of us.
Two, actually.
We'll be back with more of our Bug Hanaho show after a short break.
Support for HPR comes from the Office of Elections, reminding residents that Hawaii is a vote-by-mail state. Registered voters can expect to receive their primary election ballots by July 23rd. Elections.hawaii.gov.
When you're out and about, stay connected on the HPR mobile app. Whether you're on a run, walking the dog, or just doing errands, take Hawaii Public Radio with you. Stream the latest news and talk from HPR One, or experience the soothing calm of classical music on HPR Two. Plus, you can see playlists, listen to interviews, and see the program schedule too. Available 24/7 right from your smartphone. Available on the App Store or on Google Play.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply, Ohana, working to protect and manage Oahu's water resources since 1929, for fresh water now and for future generations. BoardofWaterSupply.com.
Welcome back to The Conversation. This is our Bug Hanaho show. You know, living with the creepy crawlies of roaches is one thing, but having to deal with an army of invasive insects that pack a bite powerful enough to blind animals, that's a whole different story. The little fire ant was first discovered in our state on Hawaii Island in 1999. And while efforts to eradicate colonies on most of our islands seem to be turning the tide, the fight on the Big Island rages on.
The Hawaii Ant Lab is taking the lead on that effort there. Kiyoshi Adachi heads its Kona office. I got the chance to interview him last year as we were collecting research for HPR's narrative podcast, This Is Our Hawaii. His interview didn't make it into the final cut, but we held on to it because the information he shared was so riveting. So here's Adachi talking about the menacing little fire ant and its impact on the Big Island.
Here on Hawaii Island, they just have such a negative impact. They are one of the most invasive species in the world. And here in Hawaii, they just thrive. Our ecosystem is perfect for them, where they can have just so many numbers, where they dominate just about all insect species here. And it's just really scary. You may have heard like pets are going blind. People getting stung, you know, they don't bite, they sting. So their bodies react differently, similar to like bee stings and stuff, where you can have really bad allergic reactions. And I've even heard of some cases, people being hospitalized. They also affect our agriculture in such a way. They form these super colonies to where you can have, you know, almost just about like 18 queens per square foot. And the fact that they nest in anything with cracks and crevices, that goes upwards into trees also. So you figure the average 10,000 square foot lot can literally have hundreds, if not thousands, of egg producing queens. And their numbers get so big. What they start to do is, you know, there's other ant species that does this, but the little fire ant, they farm Homoptera, which is basically, you know, insects like aphid, scale, mealybug. They farm them and ranch them. They don't eat them. They actually milk them for that honeydew secretion. But in turn, you have this invasive ant protecting detrimental insects to our agriculture. And, you know, similar to like a rancher, they're going to protect their herds. Or when the herds get big, they'll move them to different areas of a plant, of a field. And so much people out there who have bad little fire ants, and they also are having, you know, problems with Homopteran insects, aphid scale mealybug, where it's causing a lot of crop damage. And workers are getting stung when they're harvesting, pruning. I've seen it firsthand where people are deciding to shut down farms because their workers go on strike. They don't want to be there on harvest time. They don't want to be pruning the trees for the next season because who would want to be getting rained on with little fire ants? The cost of mitigating the effects can take away from their profit. You know, most farmers aren't striking it rich here in Hawaii, you know, but we have such a beautiful and diverse ecosystem where we should be growing as much kaukau as we can, you know. And it's just really sad that this insect can affect us in such a way.
When you talk about that the ant stings, it doesn't bite, is it like a bee sting? Do they have a stinger, or is it just kind of the chemical that they secrete out of their body?
It's both. You know, they do have that stinger type deal towards their rear end. And what it is actually a protein injection, which causes the reaction. And the other crazy thing about them is that when one stings, it releases a pheromone also that tells everyone in the area to start stinging. So like for me, when I'm out in the field and then I'll feel like a little itch in the collar of my shirt. And then the next thing you know, my whole back is on fire.
When you do get stung, I've heard some people say they get blisters, you know, like as if they were stung by a jellyfish or something like that. Is that kind of the first reaction that happens when you do get a sting? It's a blister like a jellyfish thing?
It all depends on your body, you know, similar to bee stings where people can have a bad anaphylactic shock. Some people can get a bee sting and, you know, just don't fool around with it and it's gone in an hour. So it just depends on the person, really.
And you were saying that it impacts pets as well, right? You've seen cases where cats and dogs, their eyes have been impaired because of the stings.
Yes, for sure. So the little fire ant, they really crave protein and lipids, you know, protein and fat. So dog and cat food can be like a homing beacon for them. And what happens is, you know, these ants are, they're about as big as like a sesame seed, you know, about as big as a penny is thick. And a lot of times they're like the same color as a lot of our cat and dog kibble. So you go and feed your pet, the ants are there foraging on that food. Your pet goes to eat. If the ants end up on the muzzle and make their way towards the eyes, once that animal blinks and compresses an ant, it'll alarm that ant and that ant will go on the attack. And that's why I just see firsthand just so much blind pets nowadays. You can see their eye all cloudy. We're even catching pigs in the mountains that have milky eyes. You know, the pigs, they don't really have the best eyesight. They do rely on hearing and smell mainly. But it's just crazy to see, you know, that it's affecting our game like that. It's becoming more often than not, which is truly heartbreaking.
Where are we as a state in the fight against these ants? What kind of efforts are we making, and are we making ground on eradicating them?
So on other islands, we definitely are. Unfortunately for Hawaii Island, where it was first detected in 1999 in Puna, it took a lot of research to go into it. Because these ants nest arboreally, there wasn't really much of a way to broadcast and treat, you know, above 15 feet. So they're infesting our forest up in the canopies and there was no way to get bait. And that's where the Hawaii Ant Lab came in and, you know, worked on formulating the Hawaii Ant Lab gel matrix, which has been such a useful tool for so many people. And, you know, unfortunately for Hawaii Island, we are beyond the point of eradication, it seems like. So our stance as a unit, we have a team that can go out to places like Maui and Kauai and even Oahu and fight infestations to the point of eradication. For Hawaii Island, our main target really is to monitor our ports of entry for what comes in and what goes out. And the education to the community, you see, the little fire ant is so widespread here on the Big Island, we cannot afford to go and treat everybody's property, unfortunately. And not everyone wants us to go and treat. So one of my main missions for my office is to educate people. You have such an invasive and detrimental species. People are going to the store and buying all kinds of crazy chemicals. And that's where our education comes in. It's really to save our land and our water table and also get you the best results. When using baits, they are your least toxic option, you know, and they're also very target specific. You know, a lot of people are going and getting these broad spectrum pesticides and just cranking it all over the place, killing our beneficial insects and having residual effects on our aina, which is unfortunate. So that's kind of where we are on Hawaii Island, is the education and monitoring of our ports of entry. And it's all a service, you know, to the community. We don't charge anybody. You do have to buy your own materials, but we come out for myself. I work side by side with people until they get a management plan really locked in.
What are some of the reasons why people wouldn't want your help?
You know, I've seen it for a number of reasons. You know, some people don't believe in harming, you know. It's unfortunate. I understand it. You know, I don't kill unnecessarily, but some people don't believe in harming any one of God's creatures. It's just, you know, if they understood what it's doing to our native creatures here on this beautiful state, I would think they would understand the cause more. And then I've seen for reasons, even if it's like illegal activity, whether they're growing pakalolo or, you know, maybe to get the fighting chickens or something that they don't want nobody around.
When I first heard about the little fire ant down in Waipio, it really took me aback. Waipio Valley is one of the most fertile places on the island, if not across the state. Are there any theories or is there any speculation on how the ant got down there?
You know, it's definitely human, you know. I'm sure it wasn't intentional, but it's just unfortunate because that's how they're spreading so fast. You know, a lot of people will ask me, how fast does the fire ant spread? And I usually tell them they spread in about 55 miles an hour in the back of everybody's truck. In terms of how it got down to the valley, you know, it could have just been anything with cracks and crevices where a fertilized queen could have been. You know, it can be building material, machinery, I mean, anything with a cover can be, you know, what they travel in. I mean, we found colonies in half of a macadamia nutshell.
It could have happened at any time, really in any fashion, with the amount of vehicles or people that have gone down and come up. I mean, anybody could have brought it down there.
For sure. And that's kind of how the little fire ant benefits in Hawaii also. It's our giving nature. It's like, yeah, I get this good hulis, you know, I'm going to drop some off. You know, hey, you like come get tea leaf, you like grab hapu from my place, go, you know, take them. You know, we give, we share. And unfortunately, we're sharing one of the worst invasive species in the world unintentionally, but it just promotes the spread, you know, which is just really unfortunate.
So how do we stop these ants? They sound so indestructible.
We got to do it together as a team. For me, I always say spreading the awareness and education and letting everybody know that this resource, you know, people like the Hawaii Ant Lab, Department of Agriculture, Big Island Invasive Species Committee, you know, we're here to help and, you know, to take advantage of those services. I'm telling everyone who, even though they believe they don't have little fire ants, just survey your place anywhere from 2 to 4 times a year. Go drop some peanut butter sticks outside. Catching it early is a real key to having eradication be feasible. You know, a lot of times it's people aren't wanting to learn about little fire ants until they're getting stung. And by then is when the numbers are high. It's possibly already went to the neighbor's property, possibly went down the river already. So by going out and doing a survey, submitting the samples to someone who is versed in the taxonomy of ants, you know, it's all free services that are available there to the community. And when we positive identify little fire ants, we're there to help, you know, show you all the least toxic and most effective ways to combat them. And that's how we need to do it for ourselves.
That was Kiyoshi Adachi of the Hawaii Ant Lab talking with HPR's Russell Subiono about the continuing battle against the little fire ant on Hawaii Island.
But it's not all doom and gloom when it comes to the little fire ant. Army Garrison Hawaii, in conjunction with other military branches, will be dedicating additional funding this year to help in the fight against destructive pests. That's where Kapua Covello works, as manager for the Natural Resources Program at Schofield Barracks, which is dedicated to propagating and protecting native species found on military land.
Covello is also active in her community of Kahului, which has turned its focus to the threat of the little fire ant. Many news sites in Windward Oahu have been reported in the past year. In fact, state agricultural officials recently held a hearing to change its rules dealing with nurseries selling infested plants. Here's a rebroadcast of our interview with Covello from earlier this year.
I think the concerns of the community are that there's not enough personnel, paid personnel, to be keeping ahead of this pest, and that the little fire ant will change our relationship with Aina. I mean, as a Hawaiian, this pest is like my worst nightmare, right? I'm a person that spends time in my yard harvesting fruit and growing kalo and love being outdoors. So people who are outdoors and love being outdoors, having Oahu infested with little fire ant is going to completely change our relationship with Aina.
We should mention, you know, your day job, you're there doing what you can to protect native species. So to have an invasive like this is, terrible.
In my backyard, exactly. Yeah, I'm surrounded in Kahului by three sort of nodes where there are little fire ants. And then in the neighboring community in Waihe'e, we've been partnering there with community members to try to get ahead of that infestation too. So yeah, it's definitely close to home. You know, I do this for my day job, and I certainly don't want it affecting my family and my pets and my ability to freely utilize, you know, my land and enjoy my home.
Well, I think, you know, we have seen the cases pop up, and it is, you know, several years to monitor a site when an infestation is discovered. And we have seen them pop up repeatedly in places like Maunawili, you know, Lanikai. And some of these areas are, you know, in your neck of the woods, right, wetter areas. But these ants can be found in dry areas as well.
So it's often moved around in potted plants. Right. So the big problem at hand right now is that there's no way for people who are knowingly selling infested material for that problem to be corrected. Right. So that just exponentially creates these places where you're right that, you know, they have to be first controlled, right, treated for a year. It's every 6 weeks. So it's 8 treatments over the period of a year until you get no detection. For example, our sites that we're treating are 5-10 acres, something like that in size, some even bigger. And so that requires, you know, we're pulling together as neighbors and a community to do these treatments together, right? So we're funding the supplies and materials and the equipment, borrowing equipment where we can to actually control the ants. And so that's for a year. And then after that, it's, you know, perpetual monitoring to make sure you don't get reinfested, or, you know, you haven't missed a spot. And that's, you know, with putting out the peanut butter chopsticks, fairly easy, but it's definitely, you know, a commitment, and there's a timeline that you have to stick to. So, you know, the holidays over Christmas are difficult to get people to come out, but we really have a good head of steam controlling Kahului. I think we're 4 treatments in, so we're halfway there. And Waihe'e is, I think, 2 treatments in, 2 or 3 actually treatments in. So we're making progress in these communities, and I think other folks are really, you know, trying to work head on to do it themselves because it's that important to them. But for eradication on the whole island, we need paid staff to be doing this, right? Not everybody has people who work in conservation professionally to help get it all together and organize things. We're an exception.
I know when I've talked with John Morgan over at Kualoa Ranch, you know, they're battling an infestation over there, but he has workers and, you know, he was trying to do the right thing and plant natives and brought some things in from Big Island. And guess what? Voila, you hit little fire ant. So, it takes those kinds of, you know, resources to make a difference.
Yeah. Dedicated resources. And it sounds like the Department of Defense REPI program is funding some invasive species control projects, and Little Fire Ant Crew is supplementation is one of those. So I think that's going to be coming online sometime this spring. But other than that, you know, the state legislature needs to step up and the city and county needs to step up to really, you know, achieve eradication on Oahu. I mean, the alternative is, right, we continuously apply pesticides. We continuously apply this bait to protect our property, and it's a continual cost to homeowners. And, it, you know, I mean, it's something we'd like to apply, get rid of them, and not have to continuously, you know, apply this to our environment. Although that being said, the baits are fairly benign.
Well, the hearing that you attended, I mean, I know the concern is to have some rules in place to make sure that, you know, there's some transparency in these nurseries that are infested, that either there's some kind of notice to the public so they check their stock if, you know, they're going to buy plants.
I 100% support the amendment to the rule to, you know, make it possible for Department of Ag to enforce a quarantine, you know, or mandatory treatment of the materials before they are sold. That being said, there's a lot you can do as an individual, right? You can ask those hard questions when you go to the garden shop or when you're working with a landscaping team. Are you buying clean plants? Can you show me documentation that you're working with, you know, a clean industry member? Also, you know, people who hire yard folks, you know, I mean, that's a concern about, you know, if they're moving any material from one house residence that's infested to another. So ask those tough questions and have those conversations and let people know that you as a consumer think it's important and value their, you know, their due diligence in that regard, and that, you know, and everybody can pull together to prevent more infestations and for us then to try to just kind of get a hold of the situation as it is right now, and which is hard enough.
And what does this mean to you as someone who works out there in the boonies, you know, protecting our natives? I mean, to have an invasive, a destructive invasive take hold, I mean, share with our listeners what that means to you.
Yeah. You know, if we can't control a pest, if we don't value it enough to control a pest that's affecting our homes, our economy, you know, from the tourism standpoint, our livelihood, our relationship with Aina, then the idea that people will do it just to protect endangered species is unlikely. I mean, of course, we want to keep it out of urban areas and affecting humans and our lives. The worst case scenario is we fail in that, and then it moves into the mountains, and invasive ants are a significant pest to our native insects, right? We've got endangered insects like damselflies that are dragonflies, but they're smaller. Mm-hmm. We've got the yellow-faced bees that are important pollinators to native plants.
These ants could be just another threat to those endangered species.
Exactly. We don't need any more threats. We have enough. We're already in triage for many of these species, right? The coconut rhinoceros beetle, last time we talked, I was saying that we found the first damage to our native Lolu Hawaiian sand palm population at Makua. So that's a really sad story, right?
Yeah.
When we potentially, you know, have extinctions or change the ability of that species to exist on the landscape in the way that it should and have to put it into gardens, you know, that's a failure on our part.
No. But yeah, it just underscores just the work that you do. But thank you. Thank you so much, Kapua, for what you
do. You're welcome.
And we'll just keep on fighting.
Okay. Thanks so much, Catherine. You take care.
That was Kapua Cavello, who is working in her community of Kahalu'u in Windward Oahu to combat the spread of the destructive little fire ant. Our Bug Hana Ho continues after a break.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors, Bavarian Motor Experts, and Chaminade University.
Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi, I'm Mark Nepo, author of You Don't Have to Do It Alone, and next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about friendship as an island of safety.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
Support for HPR comes from TS Restaurants and its Legacy of Aloha Foundation, supporting the Maui community and assisting those affected by the wildfires. More about how to help by searching tsrestaurants.com Legacy of Aloha.
Wait a minute now. Pull up. You did it? First thing in the morning when I wake up, boil up to the kitchen and I cut it up. Got the toast on deck, so I spread it up with the sunny side eggs and the skillet up. Now you know I had to go ahead and level up. Avocado so fresh, can't get enough. Orange juice in the fridge, so I pour it up. Hands up real high for the breakfast club.
Welcome back to The Conversation and our Bug Hanaho Show. The invasive lace bug is a sap-sucking pest that is attacking avocado crops statewide. It's also the subject of recent research by the University of Hawaii.
These voracious little feeders latch onto the host plant, causing them to lose their leaves and fruit. Sadly, a lot of growers are seeing their favorite avos fall prey to this little guy. Weakened trees can also become susceptible to other diseases. Research educator Amjad Ahmad specializes in sustainable and organic agriculture. He sat down with me last year to talk about what his team is sharing with growers about dealing with this pesky bug.
So avocado lace bug arrived to Hawaii or started about 2019, spreading out all over. We don't know really exactly what's the origin, but in Hawaii we import a lot, right? 85% of what we consume we import, and that could always come with potential of much stuff. So we don't know exactly what's the origin, but it started in 2019 and it starts showing on the leaves. Start spreading out, and then people say, oh, what is this happening on the avocados? So we start more and more learning about it. The HDOA start also writing about it. We as a university, we start looking into it, what it is exactly. And then over time, we start needing to look for solutions. That's when we plan to do those trials to see what can we do, which pesticides are better than others in controlling this pest. So that's how it started.
How big of an impact did it start having, because you deal with farmers statewide?
So it varies between varieties. Some varieties will lose all the leaves. Some of them will still have the leaves, but then you see that spots of the infection on them. In general, there are some varieties, they have a bit more resistance comparing with others. We are still actually looking into it to determine exactly which varieties are better than others. Now, the issue usually with avocados is not like an annual crop, that like 3 months, 4 months crop. You can just tell people change varieties, right? Because it's like years till start fruiting. And you don't just tell people cut it and put something new or a variety, like for example, that has more resistance. It's not easy, right? So we need to look for solutions while we are determining, and maybe over time we can start shifting into the varieties that they have better resistance. Yeah.
People love their trees. I mean, don't have my own tree, but definitely benefited from generous neighbors. Right now you have already started the research and now you already have some results from your studies. What were the major takeaways? Knowing that there are 50 species, what are the top types of avo that are more resistant to this pest?
We are still actually determining that, because sometimes it varies by also weather. So we are not putting exactly determination, sometimes location, the intensity of the pest. That's why we don't have really a list exactly of the varieties. But what we did from the research is we determined the pesticides that do well to control the lace bug.
And with the pesticides, though, it is topical application just on the leaves?
Most of them, yes. But there is one of them, it's called systemic, that you can spray on the leaves or you can drench into the soil. Usually what's the issue also in Hawaii is that we have so many very large trees. To try to spray everything, it's really not easy. So that's why we recommend people to keep the trees a bit on the low when it comes to the size. That's easier when you try to spray them and stuff like this. So that's one recommendation is to deal with it. Like if you have, for example, 15, 20 feet long trees, how are you going to reach all the way there to spray all the leaves? So that gets harder with the larger leaves.
So if we were talking about like a 20-foot tree, does it hurt the tree for you to say all of a sudden, okay, we're going to bring you down so we can start applying the pesticide?
You may get a bit lower yield from what you used to before, but then the other branches, actually, the ones that they are lower, they will start over time getting bigger, and also they will cover that lag over time. But it's much easier for maintenance when you have the tree shorter, easier to spray, to reach the entire tree, and you make more impact on the pest. You protect your tree, you are going to have yield.
How about for the people who are there organic treatments?
We tested actually different chemicals, synthetic and organic. So both, we have some examples of chemicals that can be good for both sides. Now, how good they are, that varies. Some of them, for example, 50%, some of them 90% in their efficacy in controlling the lace bug. So it varies between the chemicals themselves.
So it does vary, understanding that there are differences also just in environment and situation, sunlight, rain, but what should we be thinking of?
So we tested about 12 chemicals and we found the AdmiroPro, it can be sprayed on the leaves or it can be drenched into the soil. This one is one of the best chemical to apply. The other one is called Ecotec. That's also very good. They gave us a really good percentage of control. The other one will be Mustang.
Mustang, like the horse?
Yes, or the cars.
Okay.
And then the other one is called Sivanto Prime. Those four did the best in a control. Now, you don't have to get all of them. What we are recommending is at least three products. Now, because of COVID related delay in production and stuff, we're still dealing with some issues with getting sometime chemicals. You go and ask for them, they are not available. What we recommend is to use at least three products, not together, but after each other in a what's called rotation. What's good about doing rotation is when you keep applying different chemicals, the pest will not have the chance to build resistance to one of them because you are hitting it after with another chemical and then another chemical. Also, each chemical you use, there is a limit. You have to follow the label because the label is the law. If the label tells you, for example, four applications in a growing season, that means four applications in a year for avocado. So what to do if you want to apply once a month? You cannot apply that one four times, only once every 3 months. Having those three, four products is going to allow you to continue without exceeding the limits of each of the products, delaying the issues of pesticide resistance building. Additionally, you are not impacting the environment by having that one concentration of a chemical again and again and again in the environment. When you spray, you want to make sure you cover the leaves very well when you spray them. Now, some of them, while you are spraying, they will drop down into the soil, right? If you follow the label, there shouldn't be any issues of residual and environmental impact. If you follow the label, right? Because we don't want to abuse the chemical by applying more and more, and then we are also abusing the environment. So follow the label, because the label is the law. And it shouldn't be any issues because that's usually been studied to make sure that everything is okay.
How about neem oil?
It's not effective.
At all?
Yeah. In fact, some people are using insecticidal soap. It's doing much better than neem oil.
Really?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So Amjad, this workshop that happened on the 30th, online, available as a link, and I can listen back. For the people who attended, what sort of questions were you getting? Because these are your everyday farmers who are really experiencing the effects of the lace bug pest.
So my colleague Jensen Ueda did this pesticide trials. He is also an extension agent here on Oahu. I was able to secure the fund. He did the trials. And then we also hired a student help to collect the leaves and count the number of bugs that they are being killed over time. People are looking for alternatives to pesticides, which I understand. People really try to avoid chemicals sometimes. Additionally, because Hawaii, we have the ag within a neighborhood. So people trying to be safe to for everybody is totally understandable. We are looking for alternatives like natural enemies, maybe some agronomical practices like tree trimming, something like that. People are looking for alternatives, but we don't have. For example, for natural enemies, we know a few of them, like ladybugs, that's one of them, but not highly effective, maybe like 20%. So it's not really highly effective. The worst of the chemicals we tested was about 50%. So imagine the difference. Not very effective in controlling the lace bug. Maybe something will come up over time. It's still technically is considered a new pest. Don't forget, although it started in 2019, immediately COVID happened. So everything was delayed till late 2020, early 2021. That's when we started actually working on it just because of the lockdowns and the issues related with COVID. So we are still looking for other options and alternatives of practices. We didn't really find something yet. We are in collaboration with the Sustainable Pest Management Program led by Dr. Kunhui Wang within the university as well, looking for alternatives and stuff like this.
Are there other areas in the world that are also affected by the lace bug, and how are they hitting it?
Absolutely, mostly chemicals, because if you think about California, without actually controlling it, they are going to lose hundreds, maybe even thousands of acres, right? So yeah, mostly right now is chemicals. In fact, the work on the natural enemies started in California, but they didn't find anything that's very effective. And we are still also looking for something. Hopefully something will come up over time. I just want to encourage people to, we understand people don't want to use chemicals, but don't think about chemicals as something bad. Because between using chemicals wisely, using by the label, and between losing the entire production, what would you choose, right? Another one also, what we found that over time, if you keep that lace bug, especially for the varieties that they are highly susceptible, the tree is gonna get weakened because it loses all the leaves. And then over time, it's gonna get weaker and then gets infected with so many other diseases, not just the lace bug. And then you're gonna lose the trees. So having something at least to deal with, go by the label, don't overdose. And this way you are protecting the trees, keeping it healthy, and keep looking into hopefully something new will come up to do better over time.
That was community educator Amjad Ahmed talking with HBR's Lillian Song.
We've learned a lot about invasive bugs found in our homes and gardens, but before we leave you, we've got this week's Mono Minute featuring the scratchy calls of a common game bird.
And ironically, it's one that feeds on seeds and bugs. Thanks to the McCulley Library at the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology for these recordings of the Black Franklin. Here's University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart.
Black Franklins are a plump partridge that stand a little more than a foot tall. Male Black Franklins are particularly striking, with a jet black breast and head and a bright white patch below the eye, cinnamon-colored neck, and zebra-like striping on their backs. Given their strong legs, they're mostly cursorial, meaning they spend much of their time on the ground. But at the sign of danger, they use their short, rounded wings, along with strong breast muscles, for fast but short bursts of flight. Their calls are given only by males and can be heard throughout the year. They usually climb up to the highest nearby perch, like a fence post or a tree branch, stretch their neck up, throw their head backwards, and let out a series of four or five loud, scratchy, metallic syllables. Black Franklins are naturally found from northern India all the way to the Mediterranean. They were introduced to several U.S. states, and also Hawaii, in the 50s and 60s for hunting, but Hawaii is the only place where they survive, likely because there's fewer predators here than other places. In the few decades since their arrival, they've become common game birds on the dry leeward sides of all the main Hawaiian islands. Black Franklins spend most of their time in woodlands and grasslands, where they hunt for insects, seeds, and fruits. One of our fears with introduced birds that eat fruits is that they'll help spread the seeds of invasive plant species into new areas. However, a recent study in Hawaii has shown that for partridges like Black Franklins, most seeds they consume don't survive passage through their gut, so they likely don't contribute much to the spread of invasive plant species here. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Hawaii Forest and Trail, exploring Hawaii Island with visitors and kama'aina for more than 30 years. More information at hawaii-forest.com.
That does it for today's special showcase of our recent bug interviews. We like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments.
Here's that number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org or listen back to the conversation. Find us on all major podcast platforms.
Our program is produced by myself, Lillian Song, and Maddie Bender, with help from Savannah Harriman-Pope.
Our intern is Alyssa Salcedo. The Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello, and our theme music, courtesy of Gypsy 808.
I'm Russell Subiono.
And I'm Lillian Song. Join us Monday through Friday for more of The Conversation.